From the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette, this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We appreciate you listening to the show today. And if ever you'd like to get a question on this program, you can do that by email. Send those emails to news@wbaa.org. And you can tweet your questions as well at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, let me go back to something to start that we talked a little bit about last month. I had asked you, what are we thinking about employee raises? You said maybe by the time we do this program again, you'll have an answer. So do we have an answer?
Man of my word.
All right.
We do.
Excellent. And the answer
yes.
is?
Well, we announced just very recently that the raise pool for this year will be plus 2.5%. And we believe that'll be very competitive. It certainly would have been last year. We were at 3.5 last year, and we were the highest increases in our pay in our peer group. So from the checking around we've done, we should be squarely up with the competition and ahead of some. The as last year, and this part's not final, we'll condition the last 0.5% on each unit, academic or administrative, coming up with a plan to help us with overall challenges that we have. But that worked very, very well last year, and I think everyone was glad to participate. It's a way to get everybody in the act of becoming a little bit more efficient.
So last year, the 3.5% amounted, if I remember correctly, to about $90 million extra toward the bottom line of the university. Help me do the math here. What does 2 to 2.5% mean in terms of extra costs that the university will incur?
Well, and it wouldn't be as quite as high as you just said, but you know, our so-called general fund budget is a little over $1 billion here at West Lafayette. So it'll be a meaningful additional expense, but investing in our people and trying to remain competitive and in attracting and keeping them is very important to us.
And do those raises go for the regional campuses too?
No, we let them make their own decisions, and they've not made final choices yet.
So you mentioned that last year 3.5%. What led to the decision to be at 2.5% this year?
It's good judgment, I guess. We're trying to make sure that ends will meet. Obviously, it's all part of a set of decisions that includes what will tuition be, and you know what we've decided about that. I mean, we already had decided next year. We've decided to press our zero increase policy out further in the future. So what we want to do is as much as we can and still have a balanced budget or better, and plenty of safety net, so to speak, money in the bank, and we think this will meet all those tests.
So you mentioned the tuition freeze, and that was, of course, something else I wanted to chat with you about. You've said on this program that the tuition freeze is not sustainable forever. At some point, it's likely that tuition is going to have to go up again. You've announced that you're going to try and do it for a fifth consecutive year, and I wondered if that and the raise numbers play into each other as much as some people might think. So if you look at, hey, we've taken this tuition freeze into a fifth year, but we've had to cut back from 3.5% raises to 2.5% raises, is there a balancing act that goes on between those two numbers?
Don't forget, next year was already settled. We already had committed to no increase next year. So no. The decision we announced just recently applies to the 17-18 year, one year out beyond that. No, it's much more a matter of weighing all the expenses. We've been growing the faculty around here. We also have a much higher percentage of tenure track faculty to total than virtually anybody else. So we think investing in our people is the best thing we can do.
Is that a nice way of saying it's more expensive to have the faculty you have?
Yes, it is. Sure, it's more expensive to have people on the tenure track, but those are the best people available, we think, or they wouldn't have achieved tenure in the first place. And no, our concentration, frankly, is not on salaries and wages. We want them to be as competitive as they can. We're looking, of course, in every other corner of administrative expenses to for restraint and having some success.
So I was looking at the numbers a little bit this morning, and I was looking at the number of students in, say, spring semester of 2012 and now spring semester of this year, and there were some interesting trends. And Purdue has kind of been on the leading edge of what a number of universities are doing, which is you're changing the demographics a little bit, and it allows you a little bit more budgetary flexibility, because I've noticed that there are now, in spring of 2012, for instance, there were 1,500 more in-state students on the West Lafayette campus than there were out-of-state and international put together. And in spring of 2016, there are 2,800 more out-of-state and international students than Hoosier students in West Lafayette. So that's a shift, if you look at it that way, of 4,300 students between spring of 2012 and spring of 2016. And it's no secret that the out-of-state and the international students pay about three times what the in-state students pay.
I think you better whoa here, Stan. We better go back and look. We have a majority of our students, a significant majority of our undergraduate students, if that's what we're talking about.
No, I'm talking about the whole population of the campus West Lafayette.
All right. Well, what really matters, honestly, is the undergraduate population. The graduate students, by and large, not in every case, but by and large, are being funded by the university or by research. I mean, so if you really want to look at the effects on our budget, you have to focus on the undergraduate students, where the balance is about as it was. There was a big surge of international undergraduates in 2011, more than was anticipated. I don't think it was planned. And that's been moving through the system, and most of those students either have or are about to graduate. So the total percentage of international has subsided a couple points from about 17 maybe down closer to 15. But the total out-of-state, including the non-Indiana Americans, has remained in the mid to upper 40s.
So this is also a demographics question, because there's definitely been it has been noted by professors that the campus looks differently than it did 5 years ago. And you and I have talked about wanting to have an international campus, wanting to have a diversity of people on campus. But it definitely affects the money side of it. It definitely affects the experience of the students. Looking at just the population, there's been a shift to where now we're one of the few, if not the only, public universities in the state whose flagship campus has more out-of-state and international students than they have in-state students. Is that a trend you see continuing going into the future, regardless of the money section?
A couple things. You're quite right. We read a lot these days about various schools actively even frantically pursuing out-of-state students. Sometimes they throw a lot of money at them, that kind of thing. Purdue's never had to do that. Our reputation, both in the rest of the U.S. and then internationally, very strong thanks to our great faculty and alums. And so that's why it's not a new phenomenon here. And we absolutely think about the balance and mix. And as you and I have discussed before, we've decided to bring down just at least slightly the international percentage of our undergraduate population. And within that, to try to have more diversity, because three nations from Asia comprised, three quarters or something of our international students. And we love having them, but we'd like to have a better spread, and we do this year, and I hope we will again when enrollment comes through for the fall. But we're up significantly in students from Latin America and a few other countries. I had a long visit the other day with some students from Ecuador who naturally are very, very concerned about the earthquake down there, and they told me that they can count up to 60 members now in their little association. That would not have been the case just a few years ago.
You mentioned to the University Senate a couple of months ago that you wanted to recruit more Latin American students, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. A lot of the international students, I think, the view is on campus here that a lot of these people come from some sort of background that allows them to pay a fair amount more than the in-state students pay. I'm wondering, do you have to try to find Latin American students that are from, let's just say, well-to-do backgrounds to be able to afford a $30,000 to $40,000 a year undergraduate education at Purdue? I mean, are you targeting demographically or by income level when you seek out these African American families to send their students here?
They find us, basically. And no, one reason – actually, it's the reverse in a way. One reason that it's harder to recruit or to have, let's say, students from South America is there are fewer who can't afford an American tuition here or anywhere else. But one thing that we have done with some success is ask some of our alums to – make donations that endow scholarships for students from their home countries. This is something a lot of our international alums are interested in doing. They'd like young people from their home country to be able to access a Purdue education. So we've been able to – some of our fundraising recently, as you know, been a big uptick in funding for what we call student support, scholarships basically. And a lot of that, or a significant part of that, is international.
I had a conversation with the Canadian Consul General when he was here a couple of months ago, and I know you did as well. And he made an interesting point, and I noted to him that there are only a few Canadian students at Purdue. In fact, there are fewer from Canada than there are from Bangladesh, I noted, and that was interesting. And he says, well, that's because Canadian universities are very good, and so students from Canada don't necessarily need to go out of country to find a good place to go to college. Are you aiming your international recruiting efforts at places where that's not the case, where you maybe cannot get the kind of in-country education that you could get at an American institution?
I guess, but I wouldn't overstate the extent. I mean, to which we're aiming it at this place or that. Again, Purdue has a long history. A proud history of attracting and educating people from other countries. And I think we have a certain amount of momentum and reputation that's not true for every other school in America. And we do a few things to reach out to secondary schools in other places that have supplied students before, where we know the students arrive ready for a Purdue education, that kind of thing.
But so places where you have existing relationships.
Where we have existing relationships. I've met with some of those on the international travel I've done for the school. But again, we probably don't have to do quite as much outreach as some other schools. The applications, as you know, we keep setting records and the applications are very strong. It's much more a matter of trying to decide in admitting where to set the standards and where to lean in trying to get a more diverse overall population.
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's Monthly Conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. If you'd like to have a question on the program, send that to news@wbaa.org or tweet your question at WBAA News on Twitter. Let me get to a couple of questions that have come in. Jim Bethel, a civil engineering professor here on campus, sent in a question for this month's show, and he writes, whether one agrees or disagrees with the trend, there is a climate developing, he says, in the state related to the RFRA controversy and the recently signed bill restricting abortions. What impact, if any, do you think this could have on recruiting faculty, staff, and students at Purdue? He says, I can imagine that some very talented individuals, along with their families, who might otherwise want to work or study here, might be apprehensive about moving here when other competing institutions exist in what he calls less fundamentalist environments.
Well, Jim may imagine it, but I don't see it. I don't see it at all. It was conjecture at the time. More recently, focus has moved to other states, and so if it shows up, we'd be bothered by it. But
we should point out, though, that I mean, some of the coverage about what has gone on in North Carolina with the signing of their religious liberty law and with the Georgia governor's decision not to sign the law there, both referenced back to what happened with Governor Pence and RFRA here. So, I mean, yeah. there are people talking about it.
Yeah, they can talk, but we haven't seen it. I'm unaware of even a single instance. I'm sure there have been some express this concern. Look, I'll give you, however, something I think we ought to think about. The free speech climate on a lot of other campuses is clearly going to be a deterrent to some people who won't want to go and teach where they have to worry about saying one word that someone takes offense at, and next thing they know, they're in the dock. You want to worry about a recruiting problem, I'd worry a lot more about that. And I believe here at Purdue we have established a good climate that says, as you and I have often discussed, that we're a free speech zone. We're an area for free inquiry where Jim and all his colleagues can teach as they want, and we'll have a good contest of ideas, but you won't be punished harshly penalized for teaching as you want, speaking your mind.
Another question came in from another professor, Howie Zelaznik. He wants to know a little bit more about how you personally manage your positions on the external boards on which you serve. And he sent me a link to a story about a former Purdue administrator who's now at UC Davis. And NPR had a story on her last week, actually, having to step down from a high-paying position she had with DeVry and with a textbook publisher as well. Some people found those to be in conflict with her position as an administrator at a state university in California. And so Professor Zelaznik wants to know how you manage your outside obligations and whether there are rules that you follow in terms of compensation that you get or how it affects the way that Purdue is viewed.
Yeah, I know Howie's asking an important question. I approached this with a lot of sensitivity. I didn't accept any for a while. Now, all my predecessors have served on boards. It's a very, very conventional thing. Ms. Katehi, I think, ran out of bounds these were pretty direct conflicts of interest. She's serving on other for-profit educational boards, and in one case, perhaps a vendor to her own school. And certainly competitors. And so that probably wasn't the best judgment, and I guess she agreed with it when she was asked. In my case, I serve now on two public boards. I tried to choose them with two things in mind. One, could this be of some value to Purdue? And two, would I be any better at my job for whatever learning might come along with them? Both of them are these are two companies that hire a lot of Purdue grads, which I paid attention to, and one in state and one in a nearby state. My greater problem is nonprofit boards, and occasionally commissions to study this or that. I get tons of these requests, and I'm always trying to weigh the time commitment. I've turned down a lot of those too, but also some of them, frankly, whether profit or nonprofit, give a great opportunity to give some exposure to Purdue and to bring attention to the school, which I think is part of my job. So those are the criteria that I've tried to apply, and I'm trying to keep a limit on it. The core of the job here gets a full 40 and more out of me.
What general rules, if any, exist for not – and it, maybe it goes beyond Purdue administrators down to faculty or other staff members in terms of serving on outside boards? I know there's a form to fill out about outside income that you bring in, but is there a check made on – conflict of interest or anything like that? Or are you being able to spend 40 hours a week doing what Purdue is paying you to do, anything like that?
Right. In my case and my predecessors, as far back as I am aware of, it was part of the agreement that I came here that I could serve on those. I tell the Board of Trustees what they are, and they approve it before they okay it before I go forward. Again, I'm serving on fewer than at least one or two of my predecessors did, but that's just a choice I've made. But I think in particular you'd want to be very, very careful that not to give any appearance of a conflict of interest. And I think that's what happened to our former dean out there in California.
We've got just a few minutes left with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels on our monthly conversation with him here on this Indiana Public Broadcasting Station. Remember, you can send questions via email to news@wbaa.org or tweet them at @WBAAnews on Twitter. You mentioned being drafted into things or having conflict of interest. I have to ask, there is a draft Mitch Daniels for president movement out there. There are some people who say, look, there is very likely to be a brokered convention in Cleveland in a couple of months. I know you don't like these questions, but I am duty bound to ask you anyway. And I'm glad we're across a desk from each other in case this offends you. But I have to ask, what is your response to if your name gets brought up on the convention floor in Cleveland? Is there a red telephone on your desk where you can pick it up and say no, 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 1,000 times no?
Well, first of all, don't apologize. You're just doing your job. I should apologize because I don't have an answer. I won't be giving you an answer to this question. I think it's just wildly hypothetical and totally improbable. So nothing like that, even like that, is going to happen. And there's no conflict of interest, except it conflicts with my interest in being doing as good a job by our university as I can. I got my full attention on that. I don't think anybody's confused on that point. And that's where it's going to stay.
Well, we should point out that stranger things have happened at political conventions before. I saw this great thing on PBS a few months ago about how James Garfield wound up being president. And here's a guy who is just giving a speech at the convention and somebody on the floor goes, what about that guy? And he winds up president. And it's been so long since we've had a brokered convention in this country. I think a lot of people are looking at it with fresh eyes because it's a process that we just don't have very much in this modern political age. And we should remind people, strange things have happened at these in the past. And so, I mean, it's not outlandish to say that your name is going to come up. I mean, what do you do if that happens? It's a real possibility.
Well, first piece of important semantics, if there is more other than a first ballot coronation, which is all these exercises have been for our lifetime, basically, it won't be brokered. There won't be anybody in a position to broker. It'll be wide open. It'll be a free contest. People saying contested or open, I think, are describing it more accurately. The only other thing I can say with any confidence is it'd be a fantastic spectator sport event. I mean, because we've never seen anything like it. And in the mini-cam era, there'd be people adding, subtracting delegates in real time and reporting it to the rest of us. I think it'd have high ratings. Now, beyond that, I mean, I don't know what the chances are that it happens in the first place. If it does, though, you know, this is the process. I mean, these parties exist, both of them, to pick people who might appeal to a majority of Americans, meaning you have to, somebody who can appeal to the middle. I mean, people were focusing on the Republicans. Look at the Democratic Party. You got one candidate winning a lot of primaries, and he is almost even in most of the national or ahead in some of the national surveys. But that party's going to pick – almost certainly going to pick Secretary Clinton. They have these so-called superdelegates who didn't get chosen in primaries, many more than the Republicans do. And they have every right to go there and exercise their judgments, just like a member of Congress does or a member of the United States Senate or the Indiana legislature. They were chosen to go exercise their judgment. And if in their judgment Secretary Clinton is the person most likely to gather support from a majority of Americans, then they ought to vote for her. And if it happens on the Republican side, same thing. And so it's not logical at all to gripe about that potential outcome.
I got to ask, has anyone from any of the three remaining Republican campaigns contacted you or anybody close to you, asking for your opinion, your endorsement, anything like that?
Oh, I've heard from people over the course of time. I always politely tell them I'm a non-combatant and wish them well, but I can't have any association with them. And that's going to remain the policy.
Can you tell us which campaigns have contacted you?
I don't think I should do that.
Okay, fair enough. I wanted to ask one other thing that goes to the governor's race. John Gregg made an interesting statement not long ago. He said that he was asked who is his role model as he runs for governor, and he said you. How does that make you feel?
I'm gratified, I suppose, by it. I think what I've read anyway that he said was that our approach to that office was to think big and to try to bring positive change to the state, not to be a caretaker. And that was our approach. I think he also mentioned that we emphasized economic growth and prosperity of Hoosiers and trying to have a stronger economy and opportunities, more opportunities for people young and old? Absolutely. It's exactly what we work on every single day. And we thought that was the most important thing to do. Those are the two things that I've seen him mention. And I just hope whoever serves as governor next time and the time after and the time after will embrace those two general principles, because I always said that my fondest hope for our 8 years is that we would change the expectations of people in this state, that good enough, you know, would not be good enough, and we would strive for excellence, which we achieved in many, many areas, and we achieved national distinction in many, many areas, and I want us to stay there. So I hope whether it's Democrat or Republican governors, they will aim high, as we always used to say. They can have their own priorities, but let's go after big achievements. Like the best business climate in America, or the most reformed education system, or the lowest property taxes, or the biggest investments in infrastructure, and all these sorts of things that we did. And that's the kind of Indiana that we want to have. By the way, the kind that will keep Purdue's graduates here in the state productively employed and occupied, and that will attract great talent from other places, as you and I were just discussing. So to me, those aren't party matters. Governor's not that partisan in office, or doesn't have to be. Goals like that, great economy, great education, good public services, the things that, you know, a BMV that actually works, all these sorts of things we worked on. If that's what he's talking about, then thank you, John, and Godspeed.
So as you get further and further away from holding that office, do you find yourself more interested in the outcomes, or more wanting to just keep yourself, if not at arm's length, and legs length as well, and maybe further than that? Is your interest getting greater or lessening in just watching what happens?
Oh, I watch with interest, but it's not as interesting to me, honestly, as the assignment I have now. I'm totally absorbed in that, and I feel very grateful and at peace with where things are. I mean, we had a lot of people, as those 8 years finished, who were very downcast, and they thought this great period, this Camelot period in their life, would end. And I said, listen, everything ends sometime, and the question is, how do you want it to end? And we at least felt that it ended very well. We left a place in rock-solid financial shape, with a great business climate, one of the best anywhere, with a lot of institutions reformed, with a state government that actually works, and then on to a great new opportunity, which showed up. And so I'm sure I pay attention, but it's somebody else's job now, and it's going to be somebody else's job at some point in the future. I just, whoever they are, whatever party they are, I just wish them well on behalf of all of us, and I'll try to be productive in some other way as long as somebody wants me.
Well, as always happens, we've run out of time before I ran out of questions, so we've got more we can talk about next month, and looking forward to it.
Yep, me too.
This has been Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. Remember, you can find all of these shows archived by going to WBAA.org and looking for the program page. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Gaylor Electric. Proud to be lead sponsor of the monthly conversation with Mitch Daniels. Gaylor provides electrical services from pre-construction design through project completion and a 24/7 service department. Information at gaylor.com.